Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series with Issue 18, American Presidents and Israel. Yesterday, we played some historical audio clips that you can still hear on our website, going all the way back to President Harry Truman, who recognized Israel when it was created in 1948 and called it maybe the most controversial and complex decision he had to make as president. This from the guy who dropped nuclear bombs on Japan, recognizing Israel. But today, the Israeli-Palestinian peace process seems hopelessly stuck. So how would a President Hillary Clinton or President Donald Trump be different from what we have now? How different from each other? And how would they handle the dual role the U.S. has tried to play over the years of staunch ally of Israel and neutral arbiter to mediate peace accords? Here to help us with this is Jane Eisner, editor of the progressive-leaning Jewish Daily Forward. Hi, Jane. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
And let me start with a couple of clips of Hillary Clinton that might show the scope of the challenge. Here is Clinton in the televised debate with Bernie Sanders here in New York in April as she gets a question from CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
Secretary Clinton, do you agree with Senator Sanders that Israel overreacts to Palestinian attacks and that in order for there to be peace between Israel and the Palestinians, Israel must, quote, end its disproportionate responses?
I negotiated the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in November of 2012. I did it in concert with President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah. I did it with the then Muslim Brotherhood President Morsi, based in Cairo, working closely with Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli cabinet. I can tell you right now, because I have been there with Israeli officials going back more than 25 years, that they do not seek this kind of attacks. They do not invite rockets raining down on their towns and villages. They do not believe that there should be a constant incitement by Hamas, aided and abetted by Iran, against Israel. And so when it came time, after they had taken the incoming rockets, taken the assaults and ambushes on their soldiers, and they called and told me, I was in Cambodia, that they were getting ready to have to invade Gaza again because they couldn't find anybody to talk to tell them to stop it. I flew all night. I got there. I negotiated that. So I don't know how you run a country when you are under constant threat, terrorist attack, rockets coming at you. You have a right to defend yourself.
Hillary Clinton in the televised debate with Bernie Sanders here in New York in April. So Jane Eisner from The Forward, she never did explicitly answer the question of whether the Israeli response was disproportionate. But how much do you think her answer demonstrates the complex task of being the mediator, which she described, you know, coming and kind of stopping Israel from doing something in Gaza, and at the same time the staunch ally of Israel that she portrays herself as, expressing the sympathy for a country that doesn't want rockets coming at it and having a right to defend itself?
Well, you're right. It is a complex task. I think it's really important to distinguish between Gaza, ruled by Hamas, which I think we all can agree is a terrorist organization, and the nearly 50-year occupation of Palestinian lands and the desire by both Israelis and Palestinians to create an independent state for Palestinians and end that occupation. You do have to deal with two very different kinds of Palestinian entities and two different situations. I mean, the Israelis withdrew from Gaza. There still is a blockade of sorts, and there still is a way in which it's not entirely free. But it is run by a group of people that are much harder to deal with than we can expect in terms of the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah.
And here's something really interesting Clinton said in her campaign speech to the Israeli lobby group AIPAC this year. There was a lot in the speech about our enduring alliance, but then she also said this.
There is one more choice that we face together, and in some ways, it may be the most important of all. Will we, as Americans and as Israelis, stay true to the shared democratic values that have always been at the heart of our relationship? We are both nations built by immigrants and exiles seeking to live and worship in freedom. Nations built on principles of equality, tolerance, and pluralism.
So, for people who don't know about the demographic changes and changing relationship with secular liberal democracy in Israel, what was Clinton hinting at there?
Well, I think she was hinting at the growing debate about religious pluralism in Israel. The majority of Israel's are not Israeli Jews are not what we think of as religious Jews, religiously observant Jews, but a growing minority are, and they are wielding more and more political power, and they've always had religious power. They've always controlled the religious mechanisms of the state. And so we're seeing more and more tension there. And I think what she was hinting at was trying to enunciate what so many of us feel, which is that we believe that all streams of Judaism ought to be equal in Israel, that Reform and Conservative Jews ought to be able to pray openly and have access to religious ceremonies and cemeteries and weddings and all of that. And these things are under constant assault now and debate within Israel.
Does the U.S. have a role to play in that, in your opinion? If Hillary Clinton goes before AIPAC, of all things, and worries out loud about the future of secular liberal democracy in Israel, what does the U.S. need to do about it, or what are its options?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that if you're asking about what American policy ought to be versus what American Jews individually ought to do, that becomes pretty tricky. I mean, because it goes to the bigger question of how much of our foreign policy is based on promoting human rights. And I think that that has evolved. You know, it's so fascinating to listen to all those historic audio tapes that you mentioned of the different presidents over time talking about Israel and the focus in the earlier decades about oil and economic and military power. And, you know, we saw in the last few decades a real transformation in American foreign policy that also focuses on promoting human rights. And so to that degree, I think it's fair for American government officials to point that out. I also need to add, though, that as difficult as some of these issues are in Israel, they are far worse in its neighboring countries.
One clip from history: when Clinton began running for the Senate from New York in 2000, you may remember the New York Post and some conservative Jewish groups tried to tag her as an enemy of Israel because she had ceremonially kissed Yasser Arafat's wife, Suha, when Clinton visited Ramallah as First Lady in 1999. It was silly, but here's a little audio from that event.
I want to tell you, on behalf of the President and his administration, that you can count on the United States and the strong U.S.-Palestinian relationship as you move forward on the path to peace. Today, I am delighted to join my friend, Mrs. Arafat, and all of you as we launch a vital new partnership to strengthen the families of the West Bank and Gaza.
So the context was 1999, Clinton in Ramallah with Suha Arafat, when they were still trying to hammer out a final status peace agreement after the Oslo Accords, when Bill Clinton was still president, that was to fail. But would she ever today promise a strong U.S.-Palestinian relationship, the U.S., the word she used there, or would it be politically unacceptable or wrong in your opinion?
I doubt that she would use those exact words. I do think it's really important for the United States to have a relationship with the Palestinian Authority. But I think we should use that relationship to also promote just what we're talking about there, which is human rights and democracy. You know, there haven't been free elections in the Palestinian Authority for many, many years. And I think that it's fair to say that its leadership may not represent the best interests of its people. We don't know because we haven't had a chance to even see that happen. But I do think that it is important to promote leadership that wants to live in peace with its neighbor and have its own freedoms. Clearly, the context there was really important because Bill Clinton, as president, was hoping to get another agreement. And in the end, unfortunately, Suha Arafat's husband walked away from it.
President Obama has alienated Prime Minister Netanyahu by pushing publicly for an end to Israeli settlement growth on the West Bank. Do you know if Clinton has a different position on that from Obama?
I don't know that her position is different. She probably wouldn't engage in the same sort of public acrimony. But she certainly pushed Netanyahu hard in the early years of her term as Secretary of State and also brushed up against the difficulty of working with him. He's not an easy man to work with. Even her husband had issues working with him, and it seems like everybody gets along with Bill Clinton. So I think that the position that President Obama took is the United States position, which is that if you're going to continue to have Jewish settlement growth in the West Bank, it makes it harder and harder to figure out how do you carve up that land to make a reasonable, sustainable, independent Palestinian state.
All right, Trump. Here is his version of trying to be both an ally to one side and a mediator in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Here is Trump in an MSNBC town hall in February with a question asked by Joe Scarborough.
Whose fault do you think it is that there hasn't been peace?
You know, I don't want to get into it. I don't want to get into it for a different reason, Joe, because if I do win, you know, there has to be a certain amount of surprise, unpredictability. Our country has no unpredictability. If I win, I don't want to be in a position where I'm saying to you and the other side now say, we don't want Trump involved. We don't want. Let me be sort of a neutral guy. Let's see what. I'm going to give it a shot. It would be so great. I would be so proud if I could do that. I don't know if it's doable. I have friends of mine that are tremendous business people that are really great negotiators. They say it's not doable. You understand a lot of people have gone down in flames trying to make that deal. So I don't want to say whose fault is it. I don't think it helps.
So Trump is being Trump there, all that about unpredictability. But he did actually say he would take a shot at negotiating a settlement. Is his answer, is his position really any different from Clinton's?
Well, it's hard to know what his position is, especially because it's changed since he uttered those words, where he's subsequently been so much more portraying himself as his staunch Israeli ally and claiming that there would be, if you will, no daylight, no disagreement between his administration and the government of Israel, wherever that is. So, you know, I think look, the America isn't neutral in that Israel is a very close ally, the largest recipient of our foreign aid. With all its flaws, the only functioning democracy in the region, the one very stable country in the region, economically and culturally and whatever. And so I think it's understandable that a United States would have a closer relationship, especially because, as we just mentioned, it's really hard to know who else to talk to on the Palestinian side.
Trump also spoke to the AIPAC conference, and he raised one issue where he and Clinton might have a meaningful difference, but it's a little hard to tell, as in many things with Trump. It's on the Iran nuclear deal, and Trump gave three top priorities in that speech. Two of them were about the Iran deal, and they were contradictory. Listen.
My number one priority is to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran.
And?
Third, at the very least, we must enforce the terms of the previous deal to hold Iran totally accountable. And we will enforce it like you've never seen a contract enforced before, folks. Believe me.
So, Jane, was your understanding that he was both saying he would dismantle the Iran deal and that he would enforce it as vigorously as possible?
I guess so, Brian. And, you know, what's most remarkable is I think he read that speech from the teleprompter.
Yes,
he wasn't even improvising.
That was
so this apparent contradiction wasn't clear to him or his speechwriters. You know, look, the Iran deal has been the biggest source of disagreement between the Israeli government and the Obama administration. Understandably, I mean, Iran has said over and over and over again that it doesn't think Israel has a right to exist. And I get it. I get why Israeli officials thought that not just this deal, but frankly, any deal with the Islamic Republic would be a disaster, would legitimize them and allow them to continue to do their mischief. That there is an honest disagreement there. I think that politically the Israelis handled it very poorly, and they lost. The agreement was passed and is being enforced. But it's also understandable why this disagreement happened, and certainly plenty of Republicans, I believe no Republican voted for it in Congress, and seeking to dismantle the deal, which would be very difficult and one could argue create many, many more problems than it has caused in the first place. But it's understandable why that's a difference in the policy platforms of the two parties.
Yes, and they certainly are different in this respect. Clinton continues to defend the deal as mm-hmm. good for Israel as well as good for the United States and good for the cause of Iran not developing nuclear weapons in the future. Trump asserts that this is a path to them developing nuclear weapons. In the primary season debates, though, almost all the other Republicans said they would dismantle the Iran arms deal. And Trump did stand out during the primaries for saying he would aggressively enforce it. So who knows what that would actually mean if he became president. The letter that 50 Republican national security officials signed this week saying Trump would be dangerous as president, it didn't mention Israel or the Palestinians explicitly. Did you see anything implicitly that suggested he would be bad for them?
Well, I think the of all the general unpredictability of this man, the very fact that even in a supposedly well-crafted speech to a pro-Israel group that he spoke all these inconsistencies really should give anybody pause. And I think to some degree they saw the danger that he poses in terms of foreign policy to go well beyond what's going on between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Are there ways of enforcing the Iran deal more aggressively or less aggressively?
I believe that there are. I think that we certainly have to make sure that they are complying with the pledge not to to develop materials that could be turned into nuclear weapons. But I think we also have to recognize that some of the criticism of Iran's behavior in the last year has been in areas that fell outside the deal. The deal was about nuclear weapons. It wasn't about other things that they are not doing well. And it's also important to recognize that we as the United States still have sanctions in place for Iran's terrible record on human rights and other issues, and those need to be maintained.
And that's it for today's edition and this week's edition of our 30 Issues election series. It's been issue 18, American Presidents and Israel. Today's installment comparing the things that Trump and Clinton have said and done with respect to their likely policies toward the Israelis and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Jane Eisner, editor-in-chief of The Forward, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.